This is The View from Tab. I'm Jim Menick.
I'm John Cruz.
And I'm Chris Baum.
Okay, we're back after a long hiatus. Most people had hoped we had gone away, and I'm afraid that did not happen because we have some new stuff that we want to talk about. And I'll give you the background. Anyone who's listening, I'll give the background on this. A couple of weeks ago, we had the Columbia tournament, and we broke to a partial double, if I'm not mistaken. It was 24 people out of about, I think, 70-some-odd. 80-some-odd? Okay. Yeah, so we broke to a partial double. And then I thought that was plenty. And actually, I will point out that I did not make the decision to break to the partial double. The decision of what to break should be, and usually is, the tournament directors. You know, and TAB people are not the tournament directors. TAB people are sitting there running the machines. We have plenty of advice to give and not necessarily an agreement. But, whoever's running the tournament, so in this case, Columbia, or, you know, at Lexington, John, Chris and Cheryl will make the decision, and John, you'll make the decision at Bronx. I make the decision for my own tournament. We do make these decisions, and the question is, how are we making these decisions, and what's the best way to make them? Because, John, why don't you said I got it all wrong, so.
Well, I didn't say you got it all wrong. Let me clarify. So Jim has a wonderful blog, Kowakian Life, which most of you are probably mispronouncing because I mispronounced for a long time. And he made a post. Well, actually, let me backtrack. I was at Emory, where I continue to be because my flight did not take off on time. And when I first heard about the break, I assumed that the partial break, because I saw an email about a partial break, I assumed that meant that everybody with a 4-2 record cleared, because I was hearing about this through the grapevine. And to be honest, it was a little off my radar because I was at another tournament. It became clear that the break was not an all 4-2s break, but it was the number 24, like 24 entries will break and everybody else doesn't break. This was rather late when I found out about it, and Jim and I sort of exchanged a couple of texts. I was just sort of curious, you know, what led to the decision. It sounded like it was basically the size of the field. And then Jim posted made a post on his blog, which I responded to. So that's where that came from. And the point that I made, because Jim made a post that commented that one of the coaches who was present, this was presumably not me because I was not present, was critical of the decision or something along those lines. And Jim said that breaks over 25% seemed to him unnecessarily generous. Something the description was, it was like a kindergarten tournament. And I couldn't quite help. Well, I posted a comment, a response, where, like a good debater, I held off on writing all my arguments because I needed to hold something in reserve for the rebuttal. But but I...
Which I didn't refute. I did not attempt to refute this.
Granted.
I think go ahead. I mean, the point
is... All I'm going to say is that my point was that Jim's own tournament broke something like 38% of the field, and it was a very similar-sized field, and that I didn't think that ruined the integrity of his tournament at all. Actually, I think that everybody was happy with that break. So I didn't understand, I guess this is going to really just go back to Jim now, because I didn't really understand the difference between Bump and Columbia in this context. Okay. And to be honest, I still don't understand the difference.
Okay. Well,
and then I have other things to say, but I figure we should start with that.
Okay. From a general point of view, I think mostly we're ruled by the exigencies of what we have to work with at any given time. And, as compared to trying to achieve an ideal that this is the right number of people to break, although I would rather have an ideal that I could try to achieve and have that being affected by the exigencies rather than the other way around. But in any case, the thing about Columbia was, I will honestly say that the argument that I was making in favor of breaking 24 was based on the percentage of people. Okay, that it seemed to me like a very good percentage of people to break out of the tournament. But I will point out there was an exigency as well. And the reason I go to 24 is because that means I can have 8 rounds. Take up 8 rooms and use up 24 judges and do it single flighted. And we had a problem with, if we went double flighted, it would have been very, very complicated, just because of our room reservations and things like that. But I honestly admit that that was not our key reason for doing it. If that were the key reason for doing it, it'd be the end of the story, I think, because we said, look, we didn't have the space, we didn't have the time, we're stuck with this, we didn't like it any more than you. But no, we actually made this as a conscious decision to break 24 out of 80 something, so like about a little less than a third of the field. Yeah, so I'm going with, is there an ideal that a third of a field is right? Now, to compare this to, remember, this was 6 rounds. So mm-hmm. we're talking 4-2s. Now, the difference between bump, I mean, I definitely have exigencies of time and of judges at bump. Mm-hmm. And I've varied everything there. But bump has a semis bid, and I do 5 rounds and not 6. I have done 6, I've done 5, blah, blah, blah. And so this year, which I think is the first time I've done it this way, was to have 5 rounds and a really tough break into a doubles round, which would be single-flighted. And double-flighted. And then go to a single-flighted octos from there. So this makes it a very tough break. So yes, I broke a lot of people, but you know, if you're only having 5 rounds, 3-2, you get a lot of 3-2s. Sure. Out of 90 people. I mean, you really do get, you know, almost half the field is going to get that. And we had a 3-2 screw, and every 3-2 did not break. Alternately, I've done it the other way around, where I've had 6 rounds, and then, I don't know what I did with 6 rounds, but I've had 5 rounds, and then breaking to a partial, a third, and so forth and so on. It's like, in a way, it's sort of much of a muchness. It seemed to me that this way was getting the most fair. I mean, I was doing it. Yeah, I'm limited by the number of rooms, the number of judges, but I mean, the amount of time and the number of judges. But I'm doing it because it seemed like a better way to give the most people the opportunity who were going to break as far as they could.
But so, that's mm-hmm. sorry to jump in, but that, yeah. See, that I guess that to me is my where I don't mm-hmm. understand the difference, because to me, and you know, there are a lot of. I guess we should jump in and say that there are a lot of different things that we're throwing around here. So, you know, to me, a 3-2 screw isn't really a thing the way that a 4-2 screw is, if that makes sense. So for the listener who, I'm assuming most listeners know the terms we're using, but maybe not in other parts of the country, by a 4-2 screw, we mean people who are 4-2 who don't have the sufficient speaker points or whatever to clear into the elimination rounds, right? So at my tournament, I have 7 prelims, right? And the reason why I have a runoff round is because I think a 5-2 screw is ridiculous. And I've always felt that way. And I understand that not every tournament that has 7 rounds agrees with me on that, but I really do feel that a 5-2 screw is painful, right? So if you can accommodate that by having some kind of partial triples or runoff round or whatever, I think that that's good. So some tournaments have now have runoff rounds to prevent a 4-2 screw, right? To give everybody an opportunity with a 4-2 to clear into the elims.
Yeah, I've done that in a number of tournaments. That, right? Yeah,
sure. Mm-hmm. And I see. I guess I agree that schedule is a real problem, right? And like, you know, you're bound by the schedule and by the room constraints. But to me, and I think this is why there was a bit of pushback on this, is that this seems like an unnecessary artificial 4-2 screw, right? It just seems that way because there's just sort of a seemingly arbitrary cutoff point. And I don't really mean this as a criticism, Jim, of you or of your decision. It's just more like this is a thing. This is why I'm glad we're doing this podcast, because I think it's something that tournament directors need to think about, right? I have other opinions on this, but I feel like I'm rambling and Chris hasn't spoken and I should,
yeah, well, that's great. I mean what was it at Lexington, Chris? I mean, you had, I mean, the two big divisions, mm-hmm. what were you, I mean, you were breaking to, I mean, you had 6 rounds.
Well, we were breaking 6 rounds to a full double, and that was mm-hmm. more or less what could fit into the schedule. There wasn't right. really any thought. We would have done that if we had half as many debaters or twice mm-hmm. as many debaters. Well, we wouldn't have had twice as many debaters because it would have been ridiculous, mm-hmm. but you know. Mm-hmm. But that's part of the calculation of how much of a field you can host. I mean, if we had added 40 debaters off the waitlist to our field, even if we magically did have the rooms, then our schedule no longer becomes a thing that people view as fair, right? If mm-hmm. you can't have a seventh prelim or a triple octafinal round or something, you know, to accommodate more people. So the schedule fits the tournament, but then the tournament fits the schedule, right? So,
I mean, I'm trying to think. I did a lot of math. John, at your tournament, mm-hmm. Beats and I did a bunch of math on your tournament, trying to compare what would happen if you had six rounds versus seven rounds, mm-hmm. and came to the conclusion that you virtually have the same results. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's also the sort of wider question here that's buried mm-hmm. underneath what we're saying, which is, you know, what's the purpose of an Elim break at all? What's mm-hmm. the purpose of having a certain number of rounds? Is the purpose to find a definitive champion? And if so, do you really want to call somebody who's the 38th seed out of prelims a champion or not, right? So how often does somebody who wins a tournament come out of that, you know, runoff round, and how often do they not? And is it the champion that matters, or is it the TOC bid level, or is it simply the experience of being in? I don't know. There's a lot of different competing viewpoints possibly there.
Interesting.
So for posterity's sake, as it were, Lexington had 48 debaters who were 4-2 or above, and 32 of them cleared. So we left out, 16?
Mm-hmm. And you broke to doubles, right?
So we broke to a full double of 32, mm-hmm. yeah. And the last one in was a Bronx Science debater, in fact.
True.
So.
Now, how many debaters in the field as altogether?
133.
So it's like 25% yeah. of the field or so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, not to, you know, blow my own horn, because I don't think I personally had anything to do with it, but Lexing probably was the hardest quarters bid that you'll see all year.
That's right.
So
I was tabbing it. It was amazing. I mean,
I'm looking at the mm-hmm. list of people who got 4-2 screwed, and I'm mm-hmm. I think four of these people are qualified to the TOC, mm-hmm. if not five. So, yeah, we had another year where I believe only one person got a bid at that tournament who actually needed it. Everybody else was already mm-hmm. qualified. So
that's a nasty tournament. That's rough. Yeah, it's really rough.
It certainly is. So.
But I mean, it does. I mean, I don't like to think that we're all running tournaments to just get qualifiers for the TOC, but it is a reasonable measure.
It is, but yeah. I want to jump in and say that to me, that actually was a big point here with Columbia. So I just want to say that Columbia is an important part of our schedule, and is a really important opportunity for people in our area, and it draws people from outside. But I don't believe that every tournament needs to have the most elite break, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I think that question is in and of itself actually related to what Chris is bringing up. Maybe I'm wrong in that, but I think that those are also related questions, right? That tournaments have different functions per se, right, or different audiences. And at the time, as I was down at Emory, right, my thought, I admit, was, this is no insult on the Columbia tournament. I think it provides a good opportunity for all the people who are there, but I thought, Columbia really needs to have that elite a break? I mean, really? I mean that mm-hmm. with respect to the tournament, right? I mean that more like, well, who is at Columbia, and are they expecting an elite break, or is it going to make people happy to have a more generous break? I don't know, but
that raises the question. Should I have, Columbia tends to get a fairly local Northeast. Sure. Field as compared to like Penn, which I'm doing in a couple of weeks, which gets a lot of people from Florida and places like that, mm-hmm. and Texas. Now, should I be more generous in a tournament where people come from further away just because it costs them more money? I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, just on the dollars and cents, which seems like an odd way to base it, but on the other hand, they're customers.
Well, what's the standard, too? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to maximize? If the real point is to have mm-hmm. more debates, then why have elims at all? Why not just give a bunch of prelims to everybody and have a big old round robin style?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I do with my novices at Bump. There's no break mm-hmm. rounds. They just debate until they they fall over, or
and
I fall over.
They do fall over. So.
Or John falls over because he and Cheryl are tabbing it. You know?
Especially in early Elim, in the Columbia double that actually did happen. I'm looking at we had a runoff round in public forum at Lexington. And so we broke all the 4-2s in PF because we had enough judges we could single flight both it and the
That's
double.
Where you got some single flighting in there, right?
Yeah. And there was exactly one upset in that entire double. Yeah. So, you know, the value of having, let's see, who the hell was it? You know, the value of having Cambridge KT advance over Bronx Science YF was the entire purpose of having that entire round. Everything else came out the way it would have if we just cleared straight to doubles. So, you know, it's a little strange, but even the 32 beat the 33. So,
yeah, well, you know, you're taking the top people. I'm trying to think. No, I pull the top people out. There's some middle ground, and if I do a runoff round and I don't take everybody, in the middle there, they're all sort of bunched together, six, one half dozen, another at the edges. Not necessarily, though. So the edges are the ones that I think you're right. They tend to go where you think they were going to go.
Yeah.
When all is said and done.
That said, that Cambridge team that beat Bronx in the runoff went on to get a bid. So they cleared all the way through to quarters. So go figure.
Yeah. Well, good for them. Yeah. Sorry, John, but
it's okay. You win some and you lose some.
Yeah, hate to root for the other guy. Yeah. So no, but seriously. There's five rounds versus six rounds versus seven rounds. So seven is fairly rare, right? I mean, who else has seven rounds? I don't tab anything else.
TOC and Apple Valley, right? I don't know off the top of my head. I
know that TOC does. So I looked at this because I remember JW always wanted to have 70 people, and I look at it, and he's right. If you have 70 people, you break 16 five twos. I mean, it absolutely does work that way. You know, or close enough to it that you can sort of expect it to happen. But when I first started going to TSC, they didn't have a runoff round. You know, so if you were not there, you were like, you really didn't break, even though you went 5-2. So the runoff round was a new thing, I think like the second year or something that I went, which is a good thing because, you know, I mean, if you're going to go to TSC, but here, I mean, what am I saying? I mean, why am I saying that? If you're going to go to TSC and you go 5-2, you should have a chance to break and get in there. So I have that expectation if I'm going to a tournament like that. I don't know if I have that expectation now if I go to Bronx, if I go 5-2. I probably do. But I know that you're going to have the runoff.
That's
but I probably,
say,
yeah.
You do have that expectation because I say that you have that expectation. Right?
That's,
I
mean, what you say, I think, is really key because we had talked about this too. So I went back and looked at the invitation, and I say in our invitation for Columbia, I don't really say much of any. I say we'll break whatever we want.
I know what you said because I investigated this.
Right.
And I say that with respect and love, Jim. But
you read it differently than I read.
No, but that's the whole point.
Exactly.
That's very important. So the invitation says we will make the appropriate break, I think, based on the numbers, something like that. Now, to me, as a customer of the tournament, I read that to mean we will break to octas, or we will break to doubles, or we will break all the people with a 4-2 record. Now, why do I think that? Because previously, that was really what I thought of as.
I can appreciate that. And I can appreciate that you think that that's implied. I mean, you're a misguided kind of person, and that's the way. No, but no, seriously. I mean, no, I do really feel. I know what you're saying. That it's from my point of view, I was saying something totally different. And I don't even know if we ever said it. I mean, I think it might have been in there for the last 50 years, for all I know. But I read it differently. But, of course, you know, thinking of it from a different perspective, I'm thinking of it in the tab room. We've gotten blah, 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 blah. But I think it needs to be, whatever it is, absolutely ought to be clear in an invitation what's going to happen or what the contingencies are that, you know, like last year we did this and we expect to sort of do it again. I mean, maybe that's all you can say sometimes because not every tournament is predictable. Although this year, I don't know, my tournament, like Bump is I mean, this year I got more PF. I thought that was actually predictable. But other than that, I mean, it's like the same tournament year in and year out. You know, I mean, it's like it doesn't change all that much. I don't think the Bronx changes all that much. Lexington doesn't seem to change all that much. So I mean, in terms of numbers and what you're trying to go for, I think there's predictability.
Not so much. I mean, Lexington changed dramatically 3 years ago.
Didn't it?
When Emory lost its bid from octos to quarters and the question moved to September in the same year, suddenly Wynn went from getting around 90-ish in LD to getting 120 plus wait list. And with expanding to the new site this year, we could expand to 130, but if we let in everybody, we would have had 170, 180 debaters.
I guess what I've seen expansion in PF in a couple of places like Princeton. And,
well, our PF numbers and, have gone up at Lexington like everybody else has, but LD's just exploded out of nowhere. So,
I think you're right, then. It's the demand for the bids as much as anything else. And knowing that if you go to Lexington, it's going to be a real, I mean, a good bid tournament. It's not going to be a junk.
Well, and we like to think our hospitality and the way we run the tournament helps a little too. So,
well, I mean, you had great tabbing staff. I can vouch for that. I mean, but
it's
absolutely
nice to have somebody actually knows how to configure a tab room in charge of things, huh? So
I said this in going into it and I say it coming out of it. I wanted to see what you would do, and I learned a few things that I don't do, and I did them, and most of them were good, and one or two of them actually are totally misguided on your part, but I most of them pretty good.
Yeah, I'm not changing the 9 categories anytime soon.
Well, the 9 categories
okay, we're off topic.
No, but the 9 look, the 9 categories is an interesting subject in and of itself. Because I mean, we got used to it. Because I understand the math of the 9 categories, and so you have a lot fewer mutual rounds in terms of, it's not a 2-2, for instance, but that 2-3 may be just better perhaps than the 2-2 you would have done in 6. So I understand that, and that's fine. Yeah, you know, so your logic is not, you know, is reasonable. It's understandable. So
I came up with a way of encapsulating it nicely, is that when you do more tiers and more levels, it is more likely you will hear people bitch about getting uneven numbers because just the numbers look uneven. However, what you also hear from people spontaneously is that they really liked the judging they got.
Yeah.
And this is the thing. What that says to me is the pref system works.
We're because sitting there.
If you like your judging, then the pref system did what it was supposed to do.
We had one panel especially that was driving me and Vaughn crazy. And we're looking at this panel because the numbers aren't working. And we're only looking at the numbers. And then we just look over the judge and say, well, wait a minute. These are all good judges. Screw it. You know, it adds up. Nobody's going to complain about these judges. And that's, and we forget. I mean, we're looking at it from that mathematical, arithmetic point of view. But from the real point of view, hey, these are people. These are very good judges, very experienced. The people that are debating know these judges, know how to work them. They're going to be very happy. And I'll be honest with you.
With a panel of 2-3, 1-2, 1-2, even the team that's going to be on the wrong end of that 1-2, 1-2 is going to be pretty happy. They're getting 3 judges who are in the top third of their pref sheet. And are reasonably close.
Yeah, so. We didn't get anybody coming in to the tab room to complain about the judging.
Good.
You know, not a single person, because I would have given them your number, but it did not happen. You know?
And do we care to speculate the likelihood that I would have actually picked up the phone?
I have someone here who wants to complain, and I'm not taking it. Yeah, sure. Well, actually, we have Cheryl right there, and they can always complain to Cheryl. That's a mug's game, but they can always give it a shot. But I mean, it's me sitting there and Vaughn and Cheryl and John and Brother John and the other side of the room. Who's going to complain about what? But they're not going to get anywhere, so they might as well just not bother. Yeah, you know, this is like the world's worst opportunity.
I also have one other brief comment before we get back out of the rat hole and back onto topic. I filled out an ordinal pref sheet for the very first time as a user because we had 2 kids go to the Harvard-Westlake tournament in LA that used it.
Yeah.
I actually found, and granted, this is from the perspective of somebody who has tabbed ordinals a number of times for the college policy community and therefore understands them pretty well. As a user, it was far, far easier to fill out that pref sheet than it is with a tiered system. And the reason why is because you don't have to worry too much about people in the bottom, and you don't have to worry about too much about distinctions you don't want to make. And what it takes away is the requirement to constantly being adding up and counting rounds and hitting targets. all of that goes away. You just put them in the order that you think that they're right. And if there are four or five judges you think are equal, you just put them in whatever order you want to. And you don't have to then hit save or look over in the right and say, oh, I have too many twos and not enough threes and blah, 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 and do all that little last minute finagling. It took me all of 10 minutes to fill out the pref sheet, and I probably didn't know who a third of the judges were and had to read their paradigms first. So it was strange because I was expecting it to be more difficult than it proved in the reality to be actually far, far easier.
I think part of it is the perception. I mean, remember, I don't do prefs. I only have one kid, and yes, occasionally I do prefs for him, but my major complaint is more moving users along this continuum of making it. Yep, the users seem to have gotten settled in now on the six tiers.
Well, we can't have them being too comfortable.
Well, I mean, but there's a lot of other things, and one of the things, I mean, they've all gotten used to e-balloting, you know, and we did it at Columbia as well, although we had a nice contained area. I mean, my worry about e-balloting, talking about getting off topic, my worry about e-balloting is over large universes, and if somebody doesn't show up, what do you do kind of thing there. But we're getting there. We're learning how to do this, I think. But the important thing is that people, the actual judges, learn how to do on their end. We're getting there. So it's just how many things can you throw at people before they just start, like, stop throwing things at me. And we had that last year at Penn, where a lot of people who had just come from Lexington, I mean, 2 weeks ago they had been to the Lexington tournament and they had been e-balloting like crazy, and they said, I can't do this, it's too hard. And they're like, you just did it, you know. It's like, you know, so I dealt with that. So,
well, part of that also is, I think, a little bit of on our fault as people who coach debate and are sort of our insiders, as it were. One of the things I've discovered about e-balloting is that we all assume, my kids assume it, I assumed it, us and Tab assume it sometimes, is that the people who are going to suck at e-balloting are the people who are like random noob judges who are parents in the home. But the thing about it is while they don't know much about debate, it's a browser web app. They all have Gmail. They all have, you know, they've used a computer before. So we tend to assume their generic noobishness is going to carry into e-balloting, and I think unfairly so. It is more likely that a parent won't have a computer.
That's the thing, yeah. They don't have the devices.
But in our attitude, we often veer into, oh, we can't do it in PF, that's just a bunch of parents. And I'm like, well, in my experience, if you go through that PF pool, try to find me a parent who's never used a computer with a browser app before. You're not going to be able to do it. So, you know, I think we set people up to get nervous about e-ballots because we're nervous about giving them to them sometimes.
Yeah. No, I think that. Go ahead, John.
No, I was just saying that's a fair point. I agree with you.
Now, I mean, part of my real issue has more been when they're far flung, and if somebody doesn't show up, and believe me, the people who aren't going to show up and they're going to give you trouble are probably more your usual suspects than the nervous parent who just goes over there. It's hard to fill in that round on the fly, and to know that there's nobody there, and to have some kid, you know, working for the tournament checking it up. So, it's just practical issues.
Yeah. You do tend to need somebody in your buildings. Yeah. You need somebody out there whose job it is to make sure to hit the button. Mm-hmm.
But we'll do it at Penn. You know, we have a bunch of buildings there. We did it last time for PF. I'm not for PF, for LD it worked fine. We'll do it for PF as well this time. Yeah. It grows. It happens. Anyhow, bringing back to the original question.
So I think we haven't really fully addressed the framework issue, as it were, which is, you know, why do we have elims? What's the purpose they serve? What are we aiming at to go through them? You know, what is their educational purpose? What's their competitional purpose? Because until we sort of get a handle on that, I don't think you can answer what the appropriate breakpoint is.
Well, what is the answer to that? Why do we have elims on these turns? I mean, it's just sort of, I mean, let's face it, one thing we do by having elims, we cut out, you know, most of the tournament from the rest of the tournament. Now, they're only getting their money's worth if they actually broke.
Well, I don't think it's that bad to have people not, you know, people who don't break usually are pretty fried at that point. Mm. I mean, one of the reasons why people break is because they have more endurance and want more debate. So,
I mean, that's absolutely true. The endurance factor is, I mean, the ability to survive is sometimes better than the ability to debate.
I would venture to say that most debaters who don't advance into an elim round are not really ready for another round anyway, right? I don't know if that's true on your teams or not, but
I don't know.
There are like, always a few in the bubble who are like, oh, if I only had that one more round or whatever. But the kid who's 2-5, mm-hmm. that kid's ready to be done after the seventh debate,
that's
right?
That's probably true.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we want to have – I mean, it is a competition. So a competition, by definition, has winners and losers. And we want to have not necessarily one winner. We might have a couple – I mean, at my tournament, I have a couple of winners.
Well, you know, that's also a question I would have about mm-hmm. the Columbia break is what value having a final and not having a full double?
Well, the final is entirely because of bids. Right. What the hell is the bid in PF there? I don't
PF
even
bid
know.
At Columbia is like quarters, semis, isn't it? Quarters, yeah.
Is so it quarters
no,
bid?
Yeah. So
no, I can't. I don't think it's a quarters it's
a,
bid.
It is a quarters bid.
It is a quarters yeah. bid. Yeah,
no
yeah.
kidding.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Quarters bid.
So you didn't need to have a final at all, right? And
yeah, it's true.
If your choice is between having 8 debates for mm-hmm. 16 kids versus 1 debate for 4, you know.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I have to admit I don't pay attention.
It's okay. There's no reason that you would pay attention.
Right. I'm just bringing it up now as a yeah. possibility. Is that better? Yeah, you know, I don't
I
know.
I would think so. I mean, that's, you know, the I mean, if the I mean, you want to I also, I mean, you said this about Lexington. I think it's really true. I mean, there's not that much of a distinction at some point between all these people that are qualifying or getting ahead. Or it's just today they did better. You know, they got up, they had the right breakfast or something like that. But they're all relatively equal debaters for the most part. I mean, the quality of TOC. I mean, occasionally there's a standout person who just wins every tournament. But for the most part, it's a bunch of people that do really, really well at a bunch of tournaments as compared to one or two standouts. And absent those standouts, it doesn't matter all that much. 6.5 doesn't another. Of course, they don't feel that way. But I don't know. What are we... I mean, I've always been a big opponent of too much debate. Like debates that go on right. like for more than like 14, 16-hour days.
Right.
And that just drives me up the wall.
But at the other time, at some level, more debate good, right? You also don't run a tournament with 3 prelims, so.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'll just be candid here and say that if we're talking, you know, it's your tournament, Jim. So you know, I'm just saying this as a.
By the way, you're not invited. You're not coming back.
I mean, no, I just say at your tournament, I actually think what one of the things that's interesting is that in recent years, you've run 6 novice prelims. And in some years before that, you actually ran like 8 novice prelims. And I guess I'm of the opinion, but, you know, we're happy to come to the Malcolm A. Bump Memorial Tournament no matter what format you use. But I guess I'm kind of the opinion that if you're going to go the non-ELIM route, that having lots of prelims are good even for freshmen, right? Because otherwise they're – to be honest with you, they're just going to be sitting around waiting for their varsity teammates to be done anyway.
Yeah.
And it's just more rounds good, right? Especially for novice. I
hear I get an easy answer for that is the building they want us out by 3:00.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, so
that's a legitimate, you know, that's a legitimate issue. I'm just saying that in a perfect world, to me, for novices, actually, I agree with Chris. Now, what's interesting is that my gut instinct is that novices shouldn't have ELIMs on some level. It should just be lots of prelims. And then, of course, that gets back to the Chris question of before of like, kind of like why, right? Why is that my gut instinct for that? And I guess something about it strikes me as more educational or at
yeah,
least
they need
more,
the rounds and they need to debate at their level.
The rounds. It's also to some degree good for novices not to think that they're awesome superstars already.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, I've always had the most problems with the kids who win the most novice tournaments and then decide that they know everything about debate already.
Yeah,
so.
Novice success is possibly the worst thing that can happen to a novice. But I'm thinking that, you know, you're saying, I might be able to move some rounds up to the high school.
That's what I mean, that was certainly.
Yeah. I'm going to keep that in mind.
The year we did 8 was too much, but 7 is probably right.
7
is probably
good.
Both doable and right.
But it's probably better for the LD. I mean, the PF being smaller, aren't they like running out of people?
Yeah, they don't care. They're novices. See, we're thinking about that like you would think about. About
70,
you know,
20.
Novice doesn't know what a triple pull up is. So, you know.
I don't know if I have the rooms or not, but I'll look into that. I mean, that's absolutely, you know, I'm, yeah, I couldn't care less. I mean, I'm not going anywhere. So if they right. want to debate, they can debate until they, you know, they drop. But, you know, like I said, it's hard for me to keep them in a building where it's going to cost me a lot more money if they sure. stay past a certain time. Yeah. But, you know.
It makes that bus mm-hmm. ride home a lot better, too, when you tire the hell out of them.
Agreed. So.
I could have like a track meet or something. You know, that's usually available for us.
How about
you know?
Some chloroform?
Actually, should I say this? I'm going to say it. The best teaching technique I learned at debate camp was the one time I taught a middle school lab with Sandy Berkowitz, and she warned me that the first question that the middle school lab kids would ask us is, "When's snack?" And they actually did. And after one day, I was like, this is the most exhausting thing in my life. And she's like, I have an idea. And the next day, she came up with the idea that before lab, the kids would run up and down flights of stairs. And it was brilliant. And I say this entire story because one of my middle school alumni was actually at the Lexington Winter Invitational, and that made me feel very old. Okay, moving on.
Well, John, if you want to run my kids up and, you know, the kids up and down the stairs at the bump tournament, you just go right ahead, you know, and just keep them busy. You know, there's always a few outside freezing their butts off on the swings, the little kids' swings and stuff like
they
that.
They could do laps around the bumper dome, right?
So. Yeah, I guess something, anything. Just keep them out of mischief. Yeah. So, I mean, well, anyhow, I don't think we have any real answer to ideal.
Well, there's probably, you know, there are tournaments where we want to know who won, and then there are tournaments mm-hmm. where we just want the kids to get rounds. And I think mm-hmm. one of the question is where's the dividing line between them? Like, if we were to cancel the TOC final and just say have a bigger break, I think you'd have riots. And, well, mm-hmm. the TOC's had enough problems with riots already, so.
They wouldn't even notice.
Yeah, no kidding, huh? And so if you did that at, mm-hmm. you know, a big Octos bid like Bronx or Harvard, mm-hmm. people would probably notice. At a quarters bid, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, at a semis mm-hmm. bid, maybe, maybe not. Mm-hmm. A finals bid, well, you have to at finals bid, but, you know. Mm-hmm. No bid tournament. Do we have Elims at all? I don't know. The Boston Debate League, I've been tabbing a lot of their tournaments. What they do is they have a set schedule with 4 prelims and 3 Elims, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And so if we break to Octos, we don't have a final. And sometimes we'll break straight to a semi and not, you know, if there are eight teams in a given division, we're not going to break them all.
Right.
But yeah, it's just set in stone. The schedule is the schedule, and when we're out of rounds, we're out of rounds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, something to be said for that.
I mean, I tried to get some of this academy stuff where you didn't have where the important thing was some education, whatever that meant. You know, Monticello and at Byram Hills. But it's hard to get the numbers going in the first place at these places for whatever reason. I think there's just so many tournaments that most people can go to. And I think one of the things, our experience is so, I mean, aside from John and I have the MHL and the CFLs, you have the Boston stuff. You know, so we all have our local stuff. And aside from that, everything we do is fairly high competition kind of stuff. I mean, there's, you know, they are bid tournaments at some point, and people really are fighting for those bids. We have, you know, mutual judge preferencing, and we have all kinds of stuff going on that is an aid of enabling the most competitive event possible. And the most competitive, if it's the most competitive event possible, then it is going to have, if the goal is to get to. And I think you're right. I mean, some tournaments, it's who's won is the interesting thing, as compared to some other tournaments, like who got the bids, you know, and there might be two different things. And we can make that distinction. I mean, like, Bronx is going to be both, you know, who won, who got the bids, you know, whereas I mean, at Lexington, I think more who got the bids than who won. Not that who won isn't important. It's just that, you know, it's just viewed a little bit differently. Yeah, you know, for whatever reason. But in those, I think you have to just take that into consideration when you're deciding what you're going to do with the tournament. I think that I have to take that. I mean, if I'm going to keep working tournaments, I have to take this into consideration when we're telling people what we're going to do. And when we're working with the kids, like deciding what we're going to do, we better be like, make sense. I mean, I don't know.
I think a key part of it, to be honest with you, and maybe I'm wrong about how I understand this happened at Columbia, but I don't think people knew what it was breaking to until shortly before, basically until it was announced, right? And I think that that's probably, you know, that's no insult on you. I mean, you know, that's whatever it is, but maybe that as a best practice is something that we want to shy away from, because I just think it
It's totally contrary to any transparency stuff we've been talking about.
How can we possibly say that that's okay if we if on the other hand we don't think that's okay?
I absolutely agree, and I think this is something that I personally have missed the boat on. It just hasn't been on the radar, but it's important, and I think it needs to be important. I think it needs to be out there, clear to people, like everything else. Like, we're the big proselytizers of everything we do should be open. So, it's like, it just never occurred to me that this should, this part of it, but it is.
And, not to open up another old can of worms, but honestly, this is one of the things I've been long talking about before the concept got hijacked about having an ombudsman, is that Tabroom and Tabroom staff by default are responsible for a lot of tournament communication, but they're singularly unable to do it because the time when communication should happen is also the time when tabbing has to happen. So expecting tab staff to be your public interface to the tournament and its policies and how it runs is very foolish, because inevitably the people who come in with legitimate or illegitimate questions are coming in right when you are most busy, and then the tab room sits around and does nothing for an hour, but that's the hour when everybody else is doing everything. So using the tab staff and relying on them as default as being your mouthpiece to the tournament is never going to result in a good experience to people.
No. Our job is something else. And, we're doing that job when, like you say, when everybody else is, like, wondering what's going on, and then they're doing their job, and we're sitting around, and not doing that. We have the opposite schedule. So,
and it's something I've been wondering about lately, about us and our traveling tab circus. And there's a quirk of concern in my head that we're maybe becoming too insular, because too many of us don't go to tournaments on the other side often enough, and we don't judge rounds, and we don't experience tournaments just as consumers. And I try very hard to judge a couple rounds every year, at least. This year it's been harder than most, because with Tabroom I'm getting pulled into the world of tab all the time, and I'm even more so getting pulled into tournaments that my team is not attending more often. So but just in general, I think that we are in danger of becoming the secret cabal that we have tried to replace.
It's funny. It's at Emory, I judged a full commitment, and it was interesting. I judged a full commitment in public forum, and it was the first time I've judged a full commitment in God knows how long, right? And I still had rounds off because of, like, the key coach things, right? And it was interesting because even though my teams, we compete, like, religiously in that tournament every year. We compete religiously in Columbia, et cetera. Sort of little, like, tweaks that were made in terms of, using Tab Room and other changes they made in the tournament. You're right. I mean, I felt them differently as a tournament participant from a judging perspective, even than I did. Because, even when I'm not tabbing in a tournament, there's a difference between donating a round or two or just being there with a very big group of kids and coordinating them. And I think you're right that it's probably important that we remember that we are not always seeing tournaments from outside the room, and that's important.
Yeah, and I tried consciously at Lex to counteract that a little bit, in that I spent relatively little time in the tab room a lot of it walking around the halls just to sort of get a feel. But with the Lex schedule being such a no-brainer of a wonderful change, there was nothing really to react to.
Uneventful tournament. It was pathetic. I mean,
the way I put it is, I have a new standard for a good tournament. A good tournament is when you can walk through the halls for an entire day and never see anyone rushing. So
that's a very good way of putting it.
Yeah, and that's what we had. It was brilliant. So there it is. But at the same time, it was good to do that, and it was good to be able to do that. And I think we need to do it more.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I just don't know where.
And it needs to be somebody's job. It can't be, I'll do that when I'm not X. It's your job. But I think it's also incumbent on us to go on the other side more often than we do. It's hard to do because there's, tabbers are certainly more scarce than most other rules. But I think eventually we won't be very good tabbers if we don't do it.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, trying to just get tab people. New tab people. Anyone listening to this wants to tab, come, please, because people don't really like tabbing.
That's why, right? Yeah. I mean, people who like going to tournaments don't necessarily like being stuck behind the veil, right? So,
But, well, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, I went for, although I went for tournaments for years. I judged every round like everybody else and then sort of eased my way into tapping because I just got tired of judging. But, I mean, that was after, that was like after 10, 15 years of doing a lot of judging, you know, so. I know, but I think things change too. I mean, it's like the tournament today is nothing like the tournaments that I went to. I mean, the rounds certainly aren't the same. Well, PF they are. I mean, PF is like LD used to be. And I like going. I like watching the round. I mean, last time I did any serious judging was at NDCA and had a good time doing it. You know, it was fun to watch good kids debate. So,
Well, we've come no closer to answering your original question.
No, I think, well, I think actually, no, I think...
I'm just being obnoxious.
I think it basically comes down to two standards, right? You decide if your mission is to get more debate or if it's to crown a champion accurately, I guess, because you're going to crown a champion. Mm-hmm. You can flip a coin and crown a champion. But you can... Mm-hmm. And then you have to decide... within the constraints of your reality, you have to sort of say, how likely is this runoff round to produce useful results? Because if your entire purpose is to crown a champion and you're going to run a runoff where there are no upsets, then you've just wasted a whole lot of time. But if you think there's a strong educational value in having that round and having all the bottom seats get crushed anyway, then that's good. Because insofar as that is true, that's why we do debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think the latter is going to be more likely the scenario than the former. There are exceptions. But I also think the other thing is it needs to be clear. Like I said, we need to be transparent. We need to work it out with whoever's running the tournament, who probably hasn't given it a thought. I mean, if they're running the same tournament they've been running for the last 20 years, they're just running the same tournament. You don't think about this stuff. It's things to be discussed. With the people that are doing the tournament, because especially us, because we tend to work on other people's tournaments and bring to them experience that they do want to hear what we have to say. And the other thing is just making it clear in the invitations and things like that. So, it's unanswerable, but I think it's a good question and it's something that needs to be thought about, which is good enough. It's good enough. All right, that brings a different thing altogether, because this is something that's been hanging fire for a while. Another complaint that Mr. Cruz has about the way I do my business.
I have complaints.
One thing after the other. Anyhow, you were complaining the wait list. I've talked about wait lists in the past.
That's a very big topic.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it's a big topic insofar as you can discuss it all that at great length, but it's an interesting topic anyhow, because we have tournaments where there are wait lists. And this year, for the first time, I've had my wait list and the final number of people that want to go to the tournament haven't changed. I mean, usually the wait lists shrink like crazy, and this year wait lists have not been shrinking. So the question becomes, how do you handle a lot of people want to go to a tournament like Yale, is certainly that kind of tournament. Princeton is that kind of tournament. A lot of people want to go to these tournaments. And so you get a big wait list of, let's say, 200 people for 100 slots. Or something like that. But it doesn't matter. And, okay, so then you have to go through. So what I did with Yale was I said we're going to have four or five or whatever it is. And then I just, the person who signed up first got in first. And they got their four. And then the next person who signed in got their four. And that was just the worst way of handling it imaginable. I mean, the logic was first come, first served, which, you know, is sort of an intuitive logic that makes absolutely no sense when applied to a wait list, because people will just, like, post somebody at the computer and they'll sign everybody up. And as Chris says, I mean, now everybody can sign up. You can handle dozens and dozens of people doing it at the same time. So everybody signed up at 1 o'clock.
Right.
So I have like 150 people signed up at 1 o'clock. There actually is very little discrepancy. And somebody signed up at 5 after 1 is getting shut out of the tournament. I signed up at 5 after 1. Why am I shut out of the tournament?
Well, and I also think on some level, and this is one of the points where I'll throw shade at Mr. Cruz and his tournament practices. I also think at some level it's disrespectful to people and their plans and their adults to make them get up at 1 in the morning in order to register for a damn tournament in October in the middle of their summer vacation. And the standard of who can come to your tournament should not be determined by who is able to be awake at midnight on some arbitrary date in the middle of the summer.
Fair. So, that's a fair point. I don't necessarily disagree with you.
Yeah.
I think that I would add to this discussion the following. I think that the system that Jim just described advantages kids who belong to small teams and elite teams. And the reason for that, obviously, is that if you know if every school is getting four entries, a team that has more than four kids on it, right?
Let me interrupt him because let me give you the other thing too before you say this, because that system didn't work. I mean, I'm not proselytizing that because everybody didn't get in because the 20 teams that had five entries or whatever it was got in, then nobody got in. So then I changed it. So let me put the other system out, which I think is more relevant to what you want to talk about, which was, okay, the next time I did it was at Princeton. And here I said, okay, I'm not going to do anything until after 2 weeks have passed from opening the tournament registration until 2 weeks later. So you have 2 weeks to sign up. There will be no preference to anybody because they got in earlier. And then what I did, and this I think is quite relevant to what you're saying, is okay, everybody gets, I have like 40 schools and I have 120, so everybody gets three or whatever it was. And so I did it that way. And so that I think is a better lead in, because that to me was, at least I had the fairness of, okay, you know, you didn't have to get in the first 5 minutes kind of stuff. And so I'm going to now just divvy up the slots in totally equal fashion. Okay.
Okay, so a few problems with that. In a vacuum, that's great. There's two big problems. First, I think it, as I was starting to say, necessarily advantages elite or small teams, because basically, if you have four LDers on your team, you're pretty much guaranteeing that all these kids are always going to be going to, you know, the tournaments they want to go to. Whereas it becomes much harder for larger teams to field their kids to an effective number of tournaments. And I don't want to speak for somebody who's not on the podcast, but what's funny is that I had this discussion with Cheryl at Lexington, and she, you know, she was very direct with me. She's like, I have become more sympathetic to the waitlist issue now that I'm on a team that has a lot of kids. And of course, you know, and I'm sure I wouldn't be thinking of this if I weren't running a program with 300 kids on it, right? So,
I will say that, and I'm going to agree with you. I mean, at any given tournament that I'm doing that wait list, I may not know, but I know that some of these schools are way bigger than other schools. I mean, it is very clear. So I probably have that information.
Right.
If I'm doing this. So I just want to say that from the point of view of running the wait list, I probably know if it's a big school or a small school. Okay. Right. So, I mean, I do have that knowledge.
Right. So the other thing, and this is, I think, actually just as important, is, you know, when I set up my schedule for the year, I assume I know how many kids I can send to each tournament roughly. If it becomes a guessing game, and this happened this year, right, where it was like, well, I don't really know how many entries I'm going to have, that becomes a really big problem, particularly for schools like Bronx Science, which are like, you know, part of a very large school bureaucracy where they really require a lot of paperwork done in advance, and you have to budget things, and you have all these different things. It just becomes really difficult to manage.
But isn't it more difficult to manage the possibility you wouldn't get to go at all?
I don't understand.
Well, the alternative is a world where you simply can't go to Yale because you registered 6 minutes late and everybody else got their five slots and you got zero.
I think that there's a possibility for some kind of middle ground here, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
I don't think there is, actually, because I think if you set an arbitrary preset limit and say everybody gets five slots at Yale if you register on time, then a bunch of schools get five slots, and then there are a bunch of schools that don't get slots at all. Whereas if you divided it out by like every school, we have 300 kids who want to come, and they're all from 100 different schools, and everybody gets three slots or whatever. That math didn't work, but you know what I mean.
Yes, I do.
If you divide it out equally after the fact, then you at least guarantee that everybody gets to go.
So here's what I think from that. I think I'll just be very public with this and say that I got very upset. And Jim knows that I got very upset with this, with Princeton, right? And I know that that's not a perfect comparison here, but I think it connects. But
remember, I'm the one that was doing it, so it's not Princeton. Yes. It was me.
Yeah. Okay. No, I think, Jim, if you don't recall this, I think you're going to recall this in a moment.
I got very upset
because I said, you know, I really helped out Princeton get their trophies. I did all these things for the tournament. I got them the judges. Mm-hmm. Why am I being screwed over by this tournament? And by this tournament, again, we really mean Jim. But, you know, I got irate because I said I feel I've given a service to the tournament and that should be in some way acknowledged. And I have no problem saying that at my tournament, the first schools to get an extra entry are the people who are helping me run the tab room and who are helping with some other service to the tournament. I don't really see a problem with that. And I mean, I can understand why one might see a problem with that, but I don't have a problem with that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I think that tournament directors should, if they can, take into consideration things about the entries. I really don't have a problem.
But I mean, I have
distance is another one, right?
Like, but that's not. But that's a separate question, though, right?
Yeah, these are. Yeah, I mean
you
what you're saying.
Is, you can accommodate that at the same time as you say we're not going to tell you ahead of time how many slots you have because that depends on how many different schools want to get in, right?
I mean, I'm usually running a wait list where. I'm always giving the first slots to the people that are working the tournament, and with a broad definition of working the tournament. So I think it's more like, what if you're not? I think your argument is better if it's not because you worked at the tournament or did anything for the tournament, but because you have like, all right, I have like three teams, and you have 30 teams. Now, is there a fair system for both of us? In that, I mean, should I be penalized because you have a lot of kids, or should you suffer because you have a lot of kids? And I think that's a problem. Yeah, I think that's it's a tough area.
I don't have a good answer for it necessarily. It's obviously a hole in all these arguments, as Chris is pointing out. But my point is simply that I think it's something that realistically has to be considered, and it honestly speaks to a broader issues, which we could get into at another point about like. What's the goal of having a team? Why do we have it? Blah, 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 blah. I mean, much like I think Chris was right to say that the Elim break question is completely contingent on why do we have Elims, right? I mean, I think they're just all things that need to be considered.
That's a tough one, though. Putting in that, because then I get people saying, well, how come they got more than I did? And I said, well, that's because they're working the tournament. And people will be satisfied with that answer. But you're going to get one more. You're going to get one more PFer or one more LD or you're going to get a PFer and an LD or whatever the case may be. But it doesn't really answer your question, the real question of how you is there a, some provision made for bigger? Forget the idea that you're actually doing something very direct for the tournament. But the fact that, let's say you've been going to this tournament for 50 years now, and your school always goes to the tournament, your school always brings extra judges and whatever. I mean, your school is one of those schools that certainly does that. Another school that does that is Regis. I know a lot of tournaments that I run. Regis has been a regular since, I think that
since
Eric was, was one of the apostles. And, so it goes back to, the beginning of time. And they're always, great customers. So do you want to have your customers? I mean, again, looking at it from a customer base thing, you want your best customers to be happy.
I guess I would also jump in and just say to a point Chris made before, which is a fair point, which is, what about being shut out altogether? I guess for me always, and this doesn't quite directly answer it, but it's just a point that I feel in the sake of transparency, I'll just be honest about. Like when I get extra slots for my kids, right, I usually assume I'm going to get them the week of the tournament, right? Like that I can make a reasonable gamble that, the tournament, if they're going to give me extra slots, will say, well, first we want to accommodate everyone and then we'll deal with drops, right? And it's generally predictable that a tournament will see shrinkage, in the last week or two. That happens at my tournament, just like it happens at any other tournament, right? That I'll tell people, well, if you want the extra slot, you're going to have to wait and we'll see if we can accommodate. But realistically, we can almost always accommodate. And in the rare cases where we can't, that I understand, I in that situation, I think I understand. It's more, I guess what I object to more is just the blanket policy that every school will have the exact same number of entries with no consideration, right? And I think that's appropriate for some tournaments. I think that, the Emory's and the Green Hills of the world, where that's the goal of the tournament, is to have that super elite kind of thing, that makes sense. But the reason I got so upset with Princeton, and I remember actually saying this in my email, and again, it's not Princeton the people, it's just the way that the wait list was set up. I remember thinking, it was like, is every tournament now going to be treated like it's an elite Octisbit tournament where we're going to have a very small number of entries per school? That to me is problematic, I guess. But Chris's point is still well taken, right? I mean, I get it.
Yeah, I don't know what we do. I mean, I don't know what the answer is on this.
Now we're all silent.
We've posed the unanswerable question.
Well, I mean, if you make it more explicit that folks who work tournaments can get extra slots, maybe we'll have an easier time finding tabbers.
I think you're about
true. Well, we've said it now, so anyone listening to this,
yeah, all four mm-hmm. people, right?
we get
yeah, tens. Well, I mean, I guess the danger is that, you know, as much as I am probably the quintessential insider at this point in my life in debate, I do tend to view things from an outsider's perspective more, and I do wonder about the danger of going too far down that road, because what if I'm not a Bronx that has the budget to donate trophies and mm-hmm. bring extra judges, and I'm just getting started in debate, and my first experience in debate is trying to register for a tournament well ahead of time and being told, no, you can't come. Well, I'm going to go found a Model UN team and screw you guys, right? So that's not a great thing to say, right?
Actually, I was about to say, in all honesty, you know, the interesting thing is I work very hard to make sure that if I'm bringing extra entries, that I bring extra judge, you know, that I try to cover all the entries at the very least. So interestingly, and I'll be the first one to admit this, we had like a big meltdown right before Lexington with a bunch of our logistics. And Cheryl was really nice. She actually did two things which in retrospect were beyond outrageous that I even put her in that position, right? Which was to give me extra entries that I then had to hire out some judges for, which I would never normally do. And then the worst case...
We're used to it. We have a long and glorious history of outrageous requests from Mr. Cruz at the Lexington tournament.
But specific to asking for extra entries, I find that I admit that goes against my own sort of like ethic, which is like if I'm going to ask for extra, I got to try to provide extra.
That's expected.
But yeah, of course. But then, of course, there was even I got like an extra because we had like a miscommunication about who could actually go at one point. And Cheryl was really great with that. And I actually said to her at the time, I said, you know, I really appreciate this. And I know that you allow these entries in out of the assumption that I would have these extra judges. Now I feel bad that this situation has occurred. And I actually spent time on the bus up thinking, got it. I would be really pissed if I weren't me right now. Right? Like, I'd be pretty pissed at this situation. So Chris's point, again, I don't mean to keep saying the same thing, but Chris's point is it will take.
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, it's really a tough one. Oh, well, we bring it up. You know, I mean, what can you do? You can bring it up. I don't know if you can resolve anything, everything, but, you know, you bring things up and have them out, at least in the dialogue. And that's good. Anyhow, I'm going to shut this down because we put in our usual hour or so, almost right on the button. And I think it was a pretty good discussion, actually. So, what do I know? All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I'm just going to turn this off, okay? I guess I'll take that as a rousing yes.
Goodbye.
Good. Thank you. Goodbye. All right. I'm turning it off.